The Guardian. Guardian podcasts are brought to you by Audible, the largest provider of digital audiobooks on the web. For more information on how to download your free audiobook from a choice of over 40,000 titles, head to guardian.co.uk/audible.
I'm James Randi, and you're listening to Science Weekly on guardian.co.uk.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Nell Bowes. On this week's podcast, we look at the best science books around with one of Britain's best-known science presenters.
I noticed a real absence of books about engineering, technology, about the whole process of having an idea and then that process of getting it to market.
Maggie Philbin will also be looking back on her old programme, Tomorrow's World. What predictions did it get right?
Will I carry a supercomputer in my pocket?
And what did it get wrong?
Electrically heated wall paint, which prompted hundreds of inquiries from viewers.
Plus, we spent a weekend at a London hotel and came back with interviews from the likes of James Randi.
It's in the Bible, the earth is flat. Okay, go away. I really can't do anything for you.
And PZ Myers, a.k.a. Pharyngula.
When you talk to the lay public about it, it sounds so maddeningly trivial. You know, I know how the spinal cord of a fish works. I don't quite brag about that.
This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome. Alok's still away, so I'm keeping tabs on the world of discovery and endeavour. Helping me in the studio is The Guardian's science correspondent, Ian Sample.
Hello, Neil.
Hey, Ian. We also have a science legend among us, Maggie Philbin.
I like that description.
We'll keep that for the rest of the programme. Now, for those listening outside Britain, she's perhaps best known for presenting Tomorrow's World. It was the BBC's science and technology programme for years, and she fronted it for eight of them during the 1980s. We'll return to that at the end of the programme and do some reminiscing. But first, we're going to talk books. That's because, Maggie, you chaired the judging panel of the Royal Society Prize for Science Books.
Yes, it was a really extraordinary summer. I can assure you that for about, I think it was about 5 or 6 months, I didn't get into bed, I didn't get into a bath, I didn't get onto a train or a bus, I didn't go to someone's house without a science book being, you know, under my arm and then, you know, and spending all that time reading it. It was just so wonderful. It was such a privilege. I still feel so excited that I was allowed to do it.
So what were you looking for in these books?
We had a great panel of judges, and I suppose we were all looking for something slightly different. I think what I was really looking for was a book that I could hand to someone who perhaps didn't, you know, make a habit of buying popular science books. Maybe, you know, normally they'd read a novel or a biography or something and just say, look, try this because you will really enjoy it, in the hope that that would get them started and that they would start looking through the shelves to see, oh, what, you know, what else is coming up. I think that's what I was looking for.
And so the winner was Nick Lane's Life Ascending. What was it about that particularly that you thought stood out?
I think that there were many things. I think the first thing was that, number one, the science was really good, because obviously that was a given. You know, we didn't want to be recommending books with sort of like slightly iffy science. The thing that strikes you when you pick the book up is it's really well written. It flows, it takes you through a story that makes sense. I mean, essentially he singles out, you know, the key inventions of life, as it were. And there's a wonderful structure to the whole book. And I found, you know, there are some chapters where, you know, the science is quite demanding. You know, this isn't an easy read that you can just, like, knock off in a couple of hours. I mean, that would be to really mislead people. But it's a really, I found it a really rewarding book. There's a lot in it that I didn't know. It looked forward as well as looking back, because there's a lot of Darwin about this year, which was great. But after a while, you began to think, ooh, I know this story. I've heard this. It made that sort of leap forward. And I think on a purely personal level, there was a chapter on death, and, you know, sort of talking from a scientific point of view about, you know, what happens when you die. And when I read the book the first time, I was reading it, and my parents are both elderly, and I was in their house and reading it, and I found it, there was something very, it sounds really sort of quite odd to say, reassuring about it, but it made it, the idea of death feel very natural. And then, very sadly, about 6 weeks ago, my mother did die. I mean, it wasn't expected. I mean, she is 89, or so, in that you can't, you know, but we hadn't expected it. And then I reread the book, you know, and again, you know, that chapter really spoke to me. So, you know, for me, you know, it was very powerful. As a winner, it was a unanimous choice. All of the judges felt the same way. So there were no nasty fallings out at all. You know, we all agreed that was the best.
Ian Somville, you reviewed several of the books on the shortlist. How did you find them?
Actually, I only reviewed one of them, which was A World Without Ice by Henry Pollack, who's a former IPCC member, and he's a geophysicist at University of Michigan. I've read Nick Lane's Life Ascending more as a sort of a thing to do out of joy. When this was when the book came out, and it just stood out as one of those books you wanted to read. And the others were more, apart from one actually, the others on this list were more things I felt I should review or should read for the purposes of this, really. I'd read Brian Cox's and Jeff Forshaw's Why Does E Equals MC Squared. So I'm less familiar with the others. It's a really kind of mixed bag, depending on what you focus on. A World Without Ice was incredibly detailed and comprehensive and stodgy, I have to say, in places and in a lot of places. But I came away from it with a feeling that it was so comprehensive. There was so much information in it that it was something I kind of have to keep nearby, because it takes you through all of the reasons why you would get natural climate change, why you get glacial periods and such. Like, it goes through all of the climate change arguments one by one, very simply, just dissecting everything. And he talks in such detail about how ice not only, you know, shaped the planet, steered migrations and sort of affected cultures and so on, but how we are now impacting back on it. It's not a book about a world without ice. I was kind of came to it thinking, oh, wouldn't it be great if this was like a thinking man's water world? And it was all about, you know, what we're going to do when there isn't any landmass around. But it's seriously solid stuff. It's not breezy, though.
And talking about judging a book by its title, did you find that you were judging them by their covers at all?
It's just as well we didn't, actually, because just for the moment, leaving the shortlist aside, some of the covers, and actually the majority of the covers, I thought were shocking. And it's a real shame, because in many of the books, there was, you know, a great story, you know, trying to get out. And the cover gave you no idea about what you would find inside, you know. And then coming to our shortlisted books, because we did mention it, Frederick Grinnell, you know, this wonderful American. He was a real sort of gentleman, was he? And he explained how he had his own idea for the cover of this book. I mean, just to explain that everyday practice of science, if you just pick it up, you would imagine it looks like the kind of textbook that I might have had when I was at school in the 60s. Absolutely plain, cream cover, you know, but it's sort of very random. I don't even know what that font is, but it's dreadful. It is so unappealing, you know. And you were saying that when the shortlisted books arrived, you thought this was some kind of random book that just fallen in. And I can understand it, because that's just what it looks like. But the author had wanted, he'd had this lovely idea that the cover should be that sort of image whereby you've got somebody who is, they're drawing a bird on their sort of easel, but in front of them is an egg. And I said, you know, that would have been that would have been an image that would have made you want to pick the book up and think, oh, you know, well, what's that got to do with, you know, science? And so it's really frustrating, I think, for some of the authors, because I think they're being done a huge disservice.
Well, I wanted to just mention something that one of your judges, Tim Burkhead, who's a geneticist at Sheffield University, mentioned, which I really struck a note with me. He said that reading some of these books, and certainly reading some of the ones in biology, he felt you could teach biology, certainly first year undergrad biology, through a few of these books. And I think he's hit the nail on the head in some respect with this, because I've only actually seriously been reading science books Since coming to The Guardian, actually, even in my sort of former life at New Scientist, I didn't really read an awful lot of science books because I was always doing either as a scientist as a job or I was doing it as a journalist. And kind of there are so many other things to read in life that you want to read, you know, literature and poetry and all of these other things. And so I'm reasonably new to reading science books. But reading some of the best ones, I think I've learned far more from this than I've learned from 7 years at like university, from studying it and from calling people, you know, for stories. So I think the power of some of these books shouldn't be underestimated, but I'm talking about the best ones.
It's £10,000 to the winner and it's £1,000 each to those on the shortlist. But there's rumours that this might be the last Royal Society Books Prize. What's going on there?
Well, I mean, they don't have the funding for another year. I think it would be beyond a shame. I think it would be a disgrace, really, if we didn't have that prize in place.
I agree, but I was looking at how much coverage the Royal Society Book Prize gets, and we've covered it on The Guardian for as far back as I can remember. I mean, either in the paper, online, in podcasts and such, like The Telegraph did a really nice section last week on all of the shortlist. And so, you know, there is money to actually, there is advertising to be had from sponsoring this. And I would have thought it's a kind of a no-brainer because you're immediately hooking yourself up to, you know, the most prestigious scientific organisation in the country and some of the best science writing. And so I was really surprised when I heard that they were struggling for a sponsor and that they'd indeed lost the sponsor for now.
Well, fingers crossed it'll continue. Reviews of all the books on the shortlist can be found at guardian.co.uk/science. There's also an interview with one of the other judges, Tracy Chevalier, on our books podcast. You can find it at guardian.co.uk/books podcast. We'll come back to you at the end, Maggie, with a bit of a geek fest and remember tomorrow's world.
Science Weekly.
Now, before we move on to hear from the likes of James Randi and PZ Myers, we've got a special offer. We've partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook if you sign up for a 2-week trial of their service. Audible.co.uk has 40,000 titles available to download, including hundreds of science titles. Follow the links at guardian.co.uk/audible for all the details. You can find Nick Lane's winning book, Life Ascending, on there as well.
We are moved by the untold mysteries of this creation. We cosmic assemblies of molecules that feel and think and marvel and wonder at how we came to be here. For the first time in the history of our planet, we know.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk.
Hi, producer Andy here. Now, since this programme was recorded and my presenters have long since gone home, it's come to my attention that this very podcast has been nominated for Best Podcast in the physics.org Web Awards. Hurrah! Now, while not wanting to sound like we're begging for people to vote for us, can you please vote for us? Like, now? Or the podcast gets it. Seriously. Have you done it yet? I've got all day, I can wait. Just give a little back. Is that too much to ask? Oh, and there'll be none of that polite hand clapping if someone else wins. Physics.org. Go on, off you go. Oh, I don't want to get angry. It'd just be nice. Maggie Philbin would vote for us.
Hello, I'm Tracy King. I'm the organiser of TAM London on behalf of the James Randi Educational Foundation. TAM London is a celebratory fundraising conference for science education and critical thinking, and it's 2 days of amazing speakers, exhibitors, and incredibly good times. And there's 1,000 people here who are fellow geeks, fellow science fans, and we're about to embark on, hopefully, what will be one of the best weekends of their lives.
As we welcome on stage, James, the amazing Randi!
We offer a $1 million US dollars, we're speaking of now, prize to any person or persons who can provide evidence of any paranormal, occult, or supernatural event of any kind under controlled conditions.
My name is James Randi. I'm known as the Amazing Randi as a conjurer.
and I am the founder of the James Randi Educational Foundation in the United States of America. We have come over here to London to hold the amazing meeting, that's what we call our conferences, number two for London. And very pleased to be here and to see such a fine turnout.
Is science still a black box that people are afraid of because of its perceived complexity and authority? And if so, what can we and the scientific community do to change this?
Well, to most people, not to most people, but to many people, science is a very dangerous thing because it makes atom bombs, for one thing. Yes, it also allows people like myself to recover from cancer with things like PET scans and chemotherapy and a few things like that. Yes, it does a great deal of good, and it increases our knowledge about the universe and about the world around us, which is the task of science. Through investigation, through investigating and examining evidence, but science has also created some monsters like the atomic bomb, of course, as unrelated to atomic research in general. So people often get the wrong idea. They're afraid of it and such. They should be, I think, more embracing it. And I think that's part of the public relations problem that science has always had. They need a little cleverer press agents out there to represent them more accurately. We should know how the real world works as much as we can. Ignorance is not to be tolerated in a day like this. There was a time when you could think that the world was flat and you'd get along just fine, live out your days and never know the difference. But I think, and there are some flat earthers out there, you know, who really believe that the earth is still flat. I really can't deal with them. It's a little difficult to try to talk reason to these people, but they will resist the reasons that you give because they have preferred explanations. It's in the Bible, the earth is flat. Okay, go away. I really can't do anything for you.
I read all of the statistics, like it might make you autistic, but at least it means you never get measles, mumps, and rubella. Ella.
I'm Sue Blackmore. I'm a writer, a lecturer, and a visiting professor at the University of Plymouth.
Why do you think people want to believe in the paranormal?
Lots of reasons. People want to feel that if someone they love was in trouble, they would know. They want to feel that the self is important. There's something like, it's so natural to feel that we are a soul or a spirit or something that inhabits our bodies. We just seem to think that way, that we are not our bodies, we are something that lives and runs and controls our bodies by free will. These are natural delusions we get into. They feed into the idea that there's a paranormal. They feed into the idea of life after death, of astral projection and all of these kinds of things. I think also we live in a very stressful world, increasingly fast-moving and difficult, with more and more choices. So I think a lot of people turn to psychics and astrology and all of these methods that seem to give you answers. You know, to the big question, what do I do now? What should I be doing? You know, should I marry this man? Is this person trustworthy? Should I take this job? How can I live my life? A psychic comes along and tells you, well, I know for sure with my spiritual powers, helps you, makes you feel that you can follow that as a choice and takes off some of the burden. Of course, it's a very harmful and bad thing to do, because then you don't take responsibility for yourself and your own life, and you shelve it onto someone who actually doesn't know the right answers for you. But I can understand why people do it. When I was a student at Oxford in 1970, I had the most amazing out-of-the-body experience. It still amazes me now, looking back. Most out-of-body experiences are very short, and this went on for a couple of hours and really turned into some kind of a mystical experience. And of course, I mean those words in terms of what the experience was like. But at the time, I jumped to the conclusion that that experience proved spirits, souls, life after death, astral projection, telepathy, clairvoyance, and so on and so on. And because the experience was so compelling and real seeming, as they often are, I was determined to prove to the world that there was more in heaven and earth, that there were all these psychic phenomena, because it seemed so obvious to me from my experience that there were. So I managed to achieve this. I funded my way through a PhD in in parapsychology, lots of experiments on telepathy and clairvoyance and so on. And again and again, I just got chance results. And I was so sure that I was going to find telepathy and test my, you know, I had this theory about how telepathy works, and I devised all these clever experiments to test the theory, but I couldn't find any ESP. And I kept looking, and I kept looking. The story I told here was about how people would always say, well, you can't find it here, it'll be here. There's another corner. It'll be round the next corner. It'll be round the next corner. And I went on for years looking around more corners until at some point I finally came to the conclusion, and a very difficult conclusion, that I'd been wrong.
Infection,
induction,
injection,
inspection,
palpation, lobotomy,
bipolar,
bigeminy,
biceps,
teratogenic,
testicular lumps.
Must say things like epididymo or pietus.
You can't say things like you've got a gammy cock.
My name is P.Z. Myers. I'm a biologist. I teach biology at the University of Minnesota Morris. And as a little hobby, I rip into religion and talk about atheism and science and stuff on the web.
And what do you love about science?
It's a path to the truth. That I know that sounds very pretentious, but no, it's a way of looking at the world. It's a way of taking the world apart and figuring out what's going on in it. And if you're curious about how things work, science is the way you get to the answer.
What discovery are you most proud of in your research?
Gosh, that's a tough one. But, you know, to be honest, probably my most significant discovery is getting students excited about science. I'm primarily a teacher. As for just physical discoveries that I've made, no, I discovered some things about the organization of the nervous system in zebrafish, for instance, and it's interesting and important stuff, but when you talk to the lay public about it, it sounds so maddeningly trivial. You know, I know how the spinal cord of a fish works. and it's an important part of the piece of the bigger puzzle, but still, you know, I don't quite brag about that. That's the routine, mundane, hard work of science, is getting out there and just working out the details.
And as you mentioned, you're also a very well-known science blogger. What got you into blogging, and why do you blog about science?
Well, I blog about more than just science. I blog about a lot of things. No, that was purely an accident. I'm a scientist at a small university in the American Midwest, very far from everything. And I was going slightly mad living there. And I discovered this thing called blogging and the software that was really easy to install, and you put it on your computer and you can do this stuff. And it was a way to have interesting conversations with people around the world. And it really worked well.
Hi, this is Maggie Philbin, and you're listening to the natural successor to Tomorrow's World, the Guardian Science Weekly podcast, guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly.
Make sure you subscribe to this podcast. Click the link at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly so every programme gets automatically delivered to your MP3 player. You can follow us on Twitter too, at Science Weekly. Now, keep an eye on our science pages this week. We have a video of famous geeks talking about their geek heroes. It's created by those behind the Geek Calendar, where Miss July is the Guardian's very own Alex Krotowski, and it's in aid of libel reform. The likes of Brian Cox, Jonathan Ross and Simon Singh are all supporting it. Fully clothed, I might add.
Geek, it's kind of gone mainstream.
It's definitely, I think, cooler now to accept one's geekiness.
Geekery is about... it's about passion, really, you know.
To be a geek is to be one of those people that wasn't actually part of the in crowd when they were at school, but then actually became really good in the end.
Maybe that's the definition of a geek, actually, being able to be obsessed, serially obsessed.
It's not quite the new gay, but it's something that I think people are kind of wearing as a badge of pride, as they should do.
Geek pride.
I went hiking with some friends to try and find an integer intersection of latitude and longitude, so exact integer number of degrees both ways, that had never been documented for the internet, and nearly died, but it was worth it for the geek cred.
For details, go to geekcalendar.co.uk. finally, it's time to let those memories come flooding back. Let's first transport ourselves back to 1965.
Tonight, three widely different stories. The first, medical, the case of this woman, Mrs. Olga Heppel, and the way she is keeping herself alive. The second, still in Britain, is about the way we could solve a serious future problem, the shortage of water.
We'll show you how to change the world in a minute.
A computer then analyzes that microwave signal and activates this probe, which marks the position of top dead center in relation to the position of the crankshaft.
Later in the program, these handguns and others will fire at point-blank range at the chest of this man. We shall do the experiment live with live ammunition. I must say the prospect already terrifies me.
It's an electronic Christmas card, and if I leave it open, it'll go on doing this for the next 8 hours.
Beautiful, isn't it? And it all depends on perfect timing. So, let's see what happens when I decide to have a go.
Incidentally, this chap here isn't called Rudolph, that's a silly name. In reality, he's called Keith. Keith, how would you like some moss?
The innovations we thought might be useful, like the electrically heated wall paint, which prompted hundreds of inquiries from viewers, but which was so expensive to connect up to the mains that it never caught on. Or the ideas which did make it, like the video recorder, now used in over 40% of British homes.
Welcome to Tomorrow's World. Tonight we've taken over a whole firing range. We've got a
rickety... 3 years later, Tomorrow's World brought this extraordinary film as a minicam was lowered into the core itself.
Hold it, I can see pellets. Go on back.
Just a minute. He's following me.
Yeah. You know, that almost looks like round pellets.
It sure does.
Yeah, it almost looks like fluoride pellets there.
I don't know.
But God knows what it is.
So what price alternative energy now? Well, here in Britain, North Sea oil has been flowing, and it seemed less crucial. But in countries like Japan, with no oil of their own...
And looking back over the years of dramatic developments in science, technology and medicine, it's become quite clear that futurology is a dangerous game. For instance, would it matter anyway if oil prices stay low? But will they? And what'll happen when the oil does run out?
So, will we finally be able to choose the characteristics of our babies? Eye and hair colour...
And will the plans for Star Wars actually become reality?
And will I carry a supercomputer in my pocket?
Will nuclear fusion finally take off? Or will all nuclear reactors...
Will the benefits of technical and scientific progress outweigh the damage they can do?
Tomorrow's world started at a time of great boldness and optimism. The space race was on, and in the white heat of technology, scientists were developing the tools for a bright new future.
You are looking a wasp full in the eye in three dimensions. You're seeing more than has ever seen before. A flaw in the fly's eye.
Now back to presenter Maggie Philbin, who's with us in the studio today. Tomorrow's World is a programme that science communication owes a lot to, something that this podcast, in its own small way, tries to mimic. I vividly remember sitting down to watch it with my dad. And Maggie, what was it like to work on?
Oh, it was the most wonderful, wonderful show to work on, for many reasons. I mean, just listening to those sort of clips, you know, and it is so interesting because you really did feel like you were looking at you were looking at the sharp edge of science all the time, and it's so interesting now just to look back and you think, goodness me, you know, it's, you know, that excitement in our voices, and at times the naivety, I think, of our enthusiasm about certain things. But the thing that
was so wonderful about the programme was how much we cared about it. Things have obviously sort of like changed in the way that, you know, television programmes get made, and we weren't parachuted in. We were there 5 days a week. It was a full-time job. We, you know, researched the scripts. We wrote the scripts. We sat for hours with producers thinking, how can we make, we've got 3.5 minutes to tell a really complicated story, or, you know, how can we get some visuals which are really going to help the understanding of this piece? It brought a really strong team together, and it's interesting actually, because it became rather like a university, and the people who went through Tomorrow's World, friendships, marriages, you know, were forged. So it was a wonderful experience. It was wonderful for the science. It was wonderful on a completely personal level. Brian Cox was saying how he used to watch the show. And I said, you know, if it isn't too stretching the analogy too far, sometimes I feel like one of those, you know, like an astronaut who, you know, how they talk about how they go into space and they have this wonderful experience. And then particularly the ones who never get to have that experience again, stand outside at night and they look up at the moon, longing to go and do it. And they know they can't. And that's how I feel about Tomorrow's World, because we all appreciated the time and how special it was. But we all feel the same way. We loved doing that show. And it's just such a shame that we're not doing it now. We felt passionately about it. And it's lovely that so many people remember it with great affection. And I think it's kind of nice that, you know, we feel the same way.
Ian, do you have fond memories of Tomorrow's World?
Absolutely. I think it must be really hard to overstate how many people that programme must have helped motivate into doing science. I mean, I was already pretty geeky when I was watching it as a kid, but I remember sitting down and just loving it. And every now and again, something would come on and you'd just think, even as like a 7 or 8 year old, you'd shake your head and think, no chance, that's not going to work. But always just loving that someone had identified a problem. And they'd, you know, sometimes come up with a bit of a Heath Robinson solution, but other times come up with something and you think, that is brilliant. And it really intrigued me as a kid, and I loved it. But I want to ask something. At the Royal Society, when you were talking about the judging the books, you said one of your first lines was, you said how nice it was to be standing up in front of a bunch of people without an unreliable prototype to let you down. And I love this, and I jotted it down in my notes. And I wondered, looking at it, was part of the enjoyment for us as viewers watching Tomorrow's World, thinking, when is something going to screw up? And was this an ever-present fear
for
you?
Well, do you know, I'm glad you enjoyed that. Because, I mean, you know, when we just listened a few minutes ago to all of the theme music, that music still makes my stomach turn upside down, because it takes me back to 7:30 on a Thursday night when you were about to go on with something you had a pretty good idea was not going to do its stuff. Because typically what seemed to happen was that proud inventor would turn up with their bits and pieces at the beginning of the day. Everything would be fine. You know, inventor would be having coffee, delighted, you know, really excited to be on Tomorrow's World. You know, this was his moment. And then generally around about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, that would be when it would stop doing what it was supposed to do. Or it would not do it every single time. And so then, you know, you'd see the suit jacket would start to come off. And then by the time you got to the dress rehearsal, this thing was not working at all. And at that point, because experience had shown that if you didn't remove the developers, the people connected with it, they would run onto the set during the live show. They were then taken to the other side of the BBC, to hospitality, to watch the programme through their fingers, you know, while you did your best with a piece of kit. And yeah, I do remember all sorts of things, and sometimes there was one awful incident with this device that could paint lampposts, and it was incredibly clever. It kind of had its paint and its thing, and then it whizzed up the lamppost and whizzed down. And the director said, that's really good, but you're using grey paint, because of course that's the colour most lampposts are. Could we possibly possibly have white paint because it would just show up better, you know, at night than that grey. And they were going, oh, well, I don't know, you know, it's kind of like a special kind of paint. Anyway, of course, persuaded to use white. And of course, it, you know, didn't get up the pole, you know. And what those poor people must have gone through, you know, and I say that you're chortling on your sofa going, you know, it's not going to work. And then I remember a machine with... where you and there was that delight, wasn't there, on Tomorrow's World, whenever you, because you would say what it was going to do. So here is a machine, and the really clever thing about it is it can tell the difference between 1,000 different shades of tomato, and you knew what would happen then, which is then, you know, a green and a red tomato would go down the same chute, you know. It was there was a lot of that. I tried to convince myself, you know, because I'd come to Tomorrow's World after, you know, 4 years on Swap Shop, and Noel Edmonds had actually made me see that often when things go wrong, it's much better. And that I held on so tightly to that during Tomorrow's World, so tightly. And we used to have the Friday meeting when the show would be gone over with the toothpick, and I used to try with the toothcomb, and I used to try, though I'm sure the toothpick is what it felt like, but I used to try and keep a sense of perspective, as particularly with some of the, you know, the younger assistant producers who would sometimes be almost in tears. And at one of those meetings, I remember, because I used to surreptitiously, because they did used to go on quite a long time, and I'd just be opening, because letters we used to get in those days, and I would just be opening some of the mail. And while there was a long, torturous debate about, you know, whether or not, you know, Kieran should have quite used this phrase or whatever, because we you know, we did care. I was reading this letter, and then I said, look, before we get too upset about this, can I just read this out loud? And this letter I've still got in my downstairs loo, and it went, dear Maggie, I hope you are well. I am Peter, and I really enjoy Tomorrow's World. So does Sam. Sam is my cat. He's very interested in the future.
Oh, brilliant. It just sounds like a wonderful, wonderful programme to work on. Was there anything that you felt as you sort of, as you demoed it, this really is the future? I mean, you had one of the first examples of the mobile phone, didn't you?
Yes, yeah, yes. But what you've got to remember is we were handling prototypes, so they never quite, they were a bit clunky, really. So frequently we weren't as impressed by them as perhaps we should have been. I mean, I remember one of the very first voice-activated mobile phones, and I was out in the car park saying, you know, do you know, this is what will make, you know, this will allow us to drive safely, and all I've got to do is just say, Kieran. You know, and in the end, it would have been faster to have run inside the building and grabbed Kieran. You know, it was not going to work. You know, so, and of course, you know, your impression of the technology was slightly tainted by how well it had actually behaved at the time. And I mean, even like the first supermarket barcode reader, which, because it had got a laser in, BBC. The safety officer had deemed was very dangerous, so we had to, unusually for Tomorrow's World, we had to pre-record it. And I, myself, and the cameraman were allowed to be in the studio, but then there were security blokes placed on every single door so nobody else could go in. I think we guys were just deemed to be completely expendable, I don't know, and so this was demonstrated. And it took about 45 minutes to scan a tin of peas. And I remember thinking, oh, you know, this is, why are we doing this item? It's never, this is not going to happen. Can no one see? How is this, you know, how have they spent so much money? You know, how, and so you could be very wrong.
Think about that when you go through the checkout these days.
Yes, I do. I do. Sometimes I'm dying to say, but I do manage to rein myself in. And again, it makes me sound like 102. But I remember demonstrating the first commercial fax machine. I could immediately see. I went out and bought it. It was incredibly expensive, and of course, it was rather like having the first telephone, having, you know, one of the few you know, fax machines, because I could see that would cut down my travelling time.
Do you think we should reinstate it? Do we need more? Do we need Tomorrow's World again?
I would love to see it back properly, you know. But I'd like to see it back with, you know, a team who really cared and had the time that we had to give to it. I mean, when I think back of the luxury of having a 3-minute item and having an entire week to think about how you were going to do that item. And that was it was those production values that made such a difference to the show.
Ian, you seem to be agreeing wholeheartedly.
When we were listening to some of those clips earlier, there was you know, a discussion of how microwaves would do this, that, and the other, and you thought, actually, this is something really lacking now. You don't tend to see much in the way of sort of new technologies being brought out and someone explaining how they work. And I've had to do an awful lot of this stuff in previous incarnations, doing sort of tech reporting on New Scientist. And that sort of thing, I don't know where else you would get it. I mean, there will be Radio 4 programs on in the middle of the day that will talk about that. But other than that, it's really lacking. And I think there is actually some brilliant science TV around at the moment. There are some great series, actually. I mean, they're all kind of ghettoized on BBC 4 or 3, what have you. But I think there is a place for a Tomorrow's World kind of program. And I think we do miss something in not having it anymore.
It does feel sometimes like science gets slightly, you know, not pushed to one side, but I think the key thing about Tomorrow's World was you knew when it was happening. It was happening, you know, on a Thursday between EastEnders and Top of the Pops. And so it was there. And I think, yes, I think there are some wonderful science programmes. But if you ask people, what night of the week is that on? And I know it's not quite the same, you know, that we sort of consume programmes in a very different way now. But you know, it does matter because people miss them, you know, and just because there are so many channels, it's very easy, you know, for great programmes, you know, to be missed, isn't it?
Mm. Well, the campaign to bring back Tomorrow's World starts here. Go and put a comment on the bottom of the blog if you fancy supporting that notion or even arguing against it. Maggie, thank you so much for coming in.
Oh, no, it's been lovely. It's been a real pleasure. And can I say, if you're ever asked to, you know, to judge 137 science books, it's a huge amount of work, but goodness me, it's so rewarding. I will really miss, next year I'll be so envious of whoever gets all of those cardboard boxes heaved into their halls. You know, it was a fabulous experience.
That's it for another sparkling edition of the Guardian Science Weekly podcast. Next week, you know what, I'm not entirely sure, not because we don't have anything planned, but because we have too much to choose from. Don't forget to visit guardian.co.uk/audible to get hold of your free audiobook. And our thanks this week to Maggie Philbin for coming in and being my childhood crush, and The Guardian's Dr. Ian Sample too.
This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth. He does a bloody good job. Plus, lots of help this week from Munkeet Louie, who went to the amazing meeting.
Science Weekly was presented by Nell Bowes. Thanks for listening.
Don't forget to start your free 14-day trial of audible.co.uk and to download your free audiobook. Head to guardian.co.uk/audible.
I'm James Randi, and you're listening to The Guardian. I'm sorry, what Guardian what?
Hey, love the podcast. Just a reminder to send in your opinions and your feedback. Best way to do it is to do what I'm doing and record yourself on your iPhone or on your BlackBerry or whatever. And then email it into Science Weekly at scienceweeklypodcast@gmail.com.
Once more.
There's too many words to remember.
I'm James Randi, and you're listening to the Science... wait a minute, the Guardian Science... Garden?
Science Weekly Podcast at gmail.com.
I think you should do it.
No, keep going.
I'm James Randi, and you're listening to the Garden...
your opinions and your feedback or anything about the podcast... or anything at all. Anything. Whatever.
I better write it out. Isn't that ridiculous that I have to actually write it out? I feel like a real fool. Here we go.
Science Weekly.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.